This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Sooner or later, they get it. And the greenwashing gets critiqued, as it recently has in Tampa, Florida, when people are saying they're getting local place-based heirlooms and they're really getting things that are from national distributors. That critique goes on and then people clean up their act.
The next time you're putting a slice of tomato on your sandwich, ask yourself where it came from. Not which area of the country, but which seed stock. One of the often overlooked aspects of food insecurity amid climate uncertainty is the push by big agricultural interests to get us to buy their seeds and their seeds only. Our guest this week on Sea Change Radio, Gary Nabhan, has taken the fight to the corporate seed merchants through the local food movement and seed-saving community. The director of the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona, Nabhan believes that a healthy food system is a biodiverse food system. We discuss community-based seed banks, look at the role that big ag will continue to play in our food system, and examine how climate change and a lack of biodiverse seed stocks affect people in war zones. I'm joined now by Gary Nabhan. He is the director of the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona. Gary, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be with you.
So, Gary, maybe you can give our listeners an overview of some of the work you've done over the last several decades in terms of seeds and seed stocks and your general philosophy on how important seeds are for a continued healthy ecosystem.
Well, I've tried to link food diversity through the crop diversity that reaches our tables to food security, that is resilience in our food system so that no one starves or prices don't go so high that people can't afford healthy food, and to food justice. In other words, how do we make sure that the most marginalized people in our food system are given culturally appropriate healthy options in their food system so that they're not further marginalized by the way the industrial food system works?
How would you look at it if you were a Monsanto executive, or let's say you were an advisor to Monsanto or one of these big agro-businesses? How should they approach, in your mind, the problem that they've kind of created, which is little too much invested in too few baskets, so to speak, in terms of the seed stocks?
Many of us have concerns that plant breeding and agrochemical corporations, to make their profits, have to have 100 million acres under a single crop variety. But I think even the people in those agro industries are seeing diminishing returns from that.
Is that 100 million acres just one crop, one seed?
That's right. Corn, within 3 years of some of the genetically engineered corn being released, one variety covered 200 million acres.
Wow.
And so what happens then is that that's a very large target for rapidly evolving pest or disease to get into and adapt to and evolve resistance to the pesticides or herbicides or whatever it may be. And now it's not just consumers and ethicists that are concerned about the collateral damage from that kind of big agriculture, but people within the companies themselves and farmers themselves, some of whom have, say, 60% dissatisfaction with particular genetically engineered crops. They just say that the rising costs of using them mean that they have diminishing returns, even though they're getting higher yields. Their inputs are so high that they're not making any more money than they were when they adopted those crop varieties. So it's not like the industry is immune to this or the farmers are immune to this, and it's just consumer pressure. The industry has to be concerned about it because they're really in a planned obsolescence mode with their crops. Some of these are really breaking down in terms of their utility.
But these are not dumb people, these executives. What is their plan, do you think, to try to not become obsolete?
Well, you know, I've been in conflict resolution dialogues with some of the agro industry companies about how Roundup Ready crops or glyphosate tolerant crops are having some impact on butterflies, like monarch butterflies and bees that other farmers need for their vegetable crops. And they see two things. They want to continue with the production of their crop varieties, but they're trying to do them with stacking different kinds of technologies, biotechnologies, in the crop so that the breakdown of resistance doesn't happen as quickly. That's still a dissatisfying answer to me, that we're stacking glyphosates with 2,4-5-D or 2,4-D. That just doesn't make sense to me. It's going to have even bigger impact on insects such as butterflies if we don't watch out. So they are looking at borders and buffers with more diverse crop varieties. And they're coming at it from a different angle than consumers or sustainable ag activists typically do. But they are clearly aware of the daunting problems that their own technologies have created, and they're trying to solve them within their means. And so I don't think there's any disagreement that there's impact on butterflies or bees by the industrial agricultural sector. I think we differ in our approaches to how to solve those problems.
If a Sea Change Radio listener walks into a big chain hardware store like an Ace Hardware and wants to start a tomato garden, what are their options in seeds, and what's the problem with the limited choice that that consumer will have?
Well, that's a great question, Alex. It's a double kind of trend at the same time. While industrial agriculture is diminishing in diversity, the options of crop varieties for gardeners has increased fivefold since 1990, thanks to the many nonprofit and for-profit regional seed companies that are evaluating and testing heirloom varieties and old standards, and even doing farmer-based breeding on these. So while we can think of wildlife or fish or fruit tree varieties or corn varieties worldwide and say, yes, there's been a devastating decline in diversity globally, the good news is that in the U.S. and Canada over the last 25 years, we've seen this enormous increase in the number of heirloom vegetable, grain, and fruit varieties reaching our table. And that's due to the grassroots seed conservation movement, both public and private players, who are seeking out place-based, climatically adapted varieties rather than thinking there's a one-size-fits-all variety for the whole continent. And they're collaborating with chefs and school cooks and small food product, artisanal product entrepreneurs who are getting this diversity onto our tables at levels that we couldn't have even imagined, say, in 1970. So our food system is rediversifying.
Take my little hoe, dig a hole in the ground. Take my little seed, plant it down. Tookie, 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 tidal low. We'll all dance around to see my little seed grow. Tookie, 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 tidal low. Tookie, 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 tidal low. Tookie, tied low. We'll all dance around and see my little seed grow. The rain, it come and it washed my ground, and I thought my little seed was going to drown. And I waded and I splashed, carried my seed, and I planted it again on some higher ground.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the director of the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona, Gary Nabhan. So Gary, are these grassroots seed manufacturers able to penetrate into the large-scale markets? Can consumers get them at a, say, Home Depot?
Well, I mean, that's a remarkable thing. Home Depot or Ace Hardware sees these trends happening and the changing preferences of their consumers. So if you go into Home Depot right now in the spring, you might see a fourth or a fifth of the vegetable starts that they're offering to people listed as heirlooms, not as F1 hybrid varieties, and certainly not genetically engineered varieties. So even the Home Depots are trying to make some profit and get some buzz on what they're doing with accepting heirlooms. They're about 20 years behind on this, in the sense that now we just don't want to keep heirlooms static, but we want to have farmers in different regions select them for the changing climates and water availability and all of that. So they're sort of looking at them as museum pieces, where the most interesting work is Dan Barber at Stone Barns Sustainable Ag Center has written so eloquently about, is that now farmers are taking these heirlooms and improving their disease resistance or drought tolerance or heat resistance to adapt them to modern day conditions rather than keeping them in some kind of holding tank as if they're a museum piece from the 19th century. So that's really exciting. And it means that heirloom varieties are not taking over, you know, hundreds of millions of acres like some of these genetically engineered corn or cotton or soy varieties, but they're really changing the fabric of American agriculture. In the 8,500 farmers markets that are open weekly in the United States, the varieties are the norm rather than the marginalized crops.
Are the big ag companies kind of getting wise to this? Have they, do they have kind of a stealth branding strategy? I'm kind of thinking of when craft beer really took off here in this country, a lot of the big brewers like Coors, for example, I think they have a stealth brand called like Old Plank House or something like that, that's supposed to be like this craft brew looking beer, but it's actually brewed by Coors and a big company. So is that something that consumers can be aware of? And if there are any brands that you can let us know about, that'd be helpful.
Well, we see sort of a whole process where first the large seed companies and large grocery stores deny that these vegetables are tastier or more nutritious or more colorful. And then their consumers convince them that that's what they really want. And some of them won't get into the more diversified varieties until they're 10 to 15% of the whole market. But once they reach that stage, then everyone tries to get on board. And there's, just like there's local washing, there's heirloom washing, where one time I went into a a restaurant in Massachusetts and it said heirloom tomato salad. And I asked the waitress, what heirloom tomato is in the salad? And not to disparage her, but she said, oh, I'll go back into the kitchen. And she came back out and she said, the chef says it's the heirloom tomato. That's its name.
There you go. The heirloom tomato.
That's right. Unfortunately, the waitress and the chef missed the point of this whole diversification movement. But sooner or later, they get it. And the greenwashing gets critiqued, as it recently has in Tampa, Florida, when people are saying they're getting local place-based heirlooms and they're really getting things that are from national distributors. That critique goes on, and then people clean up their act. And this is just the growing pains that have happened in every innovation in agriculture, from grass-fed beef to bison meat to sustainably caught wild salmon. We see that we don't get it right the first time, and we have to go deeper than the five-minute newscast on CNN allow people to go. And that's why your program and other programs that give a deeper and alternative view of our food system and our global economy are so important. You're doing a tremendous role in educating people about their real food choices, not just cosmetic diversification.
Well, thanks. We try. You've been writing about drought issues and how this will affect our food supply and our seed strategy for nearly a decade now. And the drought situations have increased. And here in California, we've had really as bad a drought as we've had in over a century. And I assume that the diversification of seed stocks will allow us to kind of combat and be able to have a more drought-resistant agricultural strategy. But maybe you can kind of delve into the science of how that works, if you will.
Well, look, you're bringing up such an interesting issue that really works at two levels, and I think we have to remember that. We're really seeing a dramatic restructuring of California agriculture and, to a lesser extent, the agriculture of every arid and semi-arid land in the world. But because California is the third largest agricultural economy, the trends seem much more dramatic right now because you've suffered tremendous drought and its consequences over the last 4 years. So, you know, we have a dramatic change in how we're using water, and that means we can't grow some crops that we did as a luxury before in California or Arizona or New Mexico. And so we see 20,000 acres of fruit trees being pulled out of the Sacramento River Valley in a single year because the Delta smelt and other fish require a minimum flow in the Sacramento River tributaries, and agriculture is going to get a reduced portion of the available river flow and snowmelt runoff and groundwater until those problems are solved. Then farmers either go out of business or they switch to different crops or different irrigation systems. Howard Buffett, probably the wealthiest Arizonan who pays attention to agriculture, says within 10 years, we shouldn't have any more furrow irrigation in agriculture in California or Arizona. We should have everything on drip or micro-aspersion technologies that deliver water to the roots of plants and not spray it all over hell and back like center pivot irrigation systems do or furrow irrigation does. Once we switch over to those things, there are certain crops with heat tolerance and disease tolerance and drought tolerance that are going to be more viable, and crops that use an enormous amount of water, like alfalfa, will only be grown by farmers on Indian reservations that are guaranteed their historic water rights, or Arab or Chinese companies that are buying land in California and Arizona to grow hay or specialty crops for their own markets and are really trading fossil fuel for fossil groundwater. So we're seeing this restructuring happen first in California, but it's going to happen all around the world. And agriculture in 10 years is going to look entirely different than it does today.
When the sun don't shine, the wind don't break, the clock don't jump off the wall. Thelma, my darling, I will cushion your fall. I will need you, feed you, sleep.
seat, you'll be with you. Without the taste of your sweet love, come on. I am only a man who's skirted the edge of despair for a long time now, and I don't care. I watch you sleeping in the hospital bed, the baby curled up in a ball. Sunlight hits the family tree, and everything else becomes nothing at all.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Gary Nabhan. He's the director of the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona. So, Gary, we were talking about seed stocks and how our food system will be transformed, whether we like it or not. The transformation is underway, and it's essential with climate change so rapidly encroaching on our way of life. How will climate change and the link to biodiverse seed stock, how will that affect people who live on the edge of war zones and on borders and whose very existence is in peril?
Well, you're bringing up the human face of suffering because of these issues. And Bruce Babbitt, our former governor here in Arizona that was Secretary of Ag under Bill Clinton, said water wars are the emerging source of most international conflicts. And the marginalized nomads and subsistence farmers that are caught between two countries' struggles for their conventional agriculture to persist will further marginalize the small-scale farmers that are not on big irrigation districts and basically usurp as much water as they can. So one of the hidden stories in Turkey, Syria, and Iran and Iraq right now is that the users upstream in the Tigris and Euphrates are starving the people who used to receive that water downstream. And the so-called drought is in part a man-made drought. In other words, it's a political drought where if someone cuts off the tap to you altogether, as Israel has done to Palestinian farmers and Iraqi farmers have done to Syrian farmers, there's very little options when you have such a highly centralized, concentrated water supply and delivery system. So the people in more diversified and smaller scale valleys will do better than the ones dependent on these highly centralized but highly vulnerable mega irrigation systems behind dams.
It's almost a secret siege or embargo, isn't it?
Right. And a friend of mine, Rami Zuryak at American University of Beirut, says that most of that Arab Spring uprising started with protests due to the rising cost of food in the peasant class. So this is a class war. This is a war against the power brokers in irrigation agriculture by the people who've been increasingly marginalized and cut off from basic resources that some people like Pope Francis and the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church, Bartholomew, say are essentially human rights, the right to water and the right to food, that many governments are now denying to people on the other side of their borders.
Now, with this reality in mind, Gary, how does a diverse seed stock give a better chance for people who are marginalized to thrive in terms of agriculture?
Well, when we quit trying to make the entire environment over to fit a few crops and fit crops to the environment that is a natural environment through water harvesting and rain-fed agriculture and local uses of materials for fertilizers, they become less vulnerable to the power brokers. And the seed stocks are a key part of this because in heterogeneous landscapes, one seed doesn't work across all soils or all rainfall regimes. And so the farmers need to quit putting all their eggs in one basket and select a group of crops that can allow them to make a living with livable wages on the natural resources available in the place that they live, rather than asking for more help from the World Bank or AID to totally transform their local environment. I've seen places in Oman where my relatives have farmed for upwards of 4,000 years, and then the U.S. Agency for International Development called their agriculture backward and put in groundwater pumping based irrigation systems. And within 20 years, the American Agency for International Development projects failed, and the 4,000-year agriculture kept going on. So we're really at a place where we need not only the diversity of seeds to stabilize our agricultural base and feed the growing population of the world, but we also need the traditional knowledge of all these place-based agricultural systems around the world that have been overwhelmed by industrial agriculture and their extension agents and seed salesmen and fertilizer salesmen. And those are the kind of people that also have, I think, destabilized American agriculture. You know, the groups like the Farm Bureau are not just lobbying groups. They sell agrochemical fertilizers, and they sell crop insurance. And in places like Arizona, they're out of sync with the majority of the farmers, which in our state are Native American farmers, not large-scale irrigation farmers.
He's the director at the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona, Gary Nabhan. Gary, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, great to talk with you. And I just have to say how important your interviews and work is in getting the word out, and how important it is that your listeners stay the critical thinkers about all these issues, because they're ever-changing, and you're providing a window into the world that you can't get on CNN or Fox News. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jazz Is Dead, Woody Guthrie, and Paul Simon.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.